Good day and welcome to Public Health Matters, brought to you every month by the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. Tune in at noon on the third Saturday of every month for information that can help you lead a healthy life. And now, your hosts for Public Health Matters.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us on Public Health Matters, brought to you by Radio One and the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. We appreciate you joining us, and we have a full show today. We have a full complement of guests. I am Kevin Brennan, and I am your host, and I am joined in studio by my co-host, Suzanne Rush.
Good afternoon, everyone. Great to be back with you.
And today we're going to be talking about the danger posed by opioids, which are a class of drugs which are also called opiates, painkillers, or narcotics. Now, opioids all work similarly in that they activate an area of nerve cells in the brain and the body called opioid receptors. Opioid receptors serve to block pain signals between the brain and the body, thereby providing pain relief and placing the user in a euphoric state of mind. So we're going to give you some context about what opioids are, and then we're going to get to some questions with our guests. So the first common reference to opioids in the United States can be traced back to the 1860s, around Civil War time, when morphine was used as a way to treat wounded soldiers. Many of these soldiers ultimately developed a dependency on the drug, eventually becoming addicted. So later on in 1898, the Bayer Company, makers of what many of us know as Bayer aspirin, introduced its new remedy for cough and pain, which was heroin. Kind of a crazy thing here to consider in modern day times. At that time, though, some believed heroin would prove less addictive than the morphine from which it was derived. However, continued reports of heroin addiction soon proved that theory to be grossly incorrect. So up to the early 1990s, the opioid crisis was largely driven by the abuse or by the use of heroin, cocaine, and crack cocaine. Shortly thereafter, the focus shifted to prescription opioids due to the widespread overprescribing of opioid medicines, most notably OxyContin. Initially, the groups most affected were older adults and persons with disabilities because they used prescription opioids to cope with acute pain that would typically follow surgery or to treat pain that came from chronic conditions such as a bad back, a hip, a knee, or a shoulder. So eventually, demand for prescription opioids grew and users from all age groups and walks of life were represented. When the availability of prescription opioids was restricted in later years due to revised policies, use shifted back to heroin. The American Medical Association estimates that 45% of heroin users started with an addiction to prescription opioids. Now, today, drugs are still being used, and the issue has become greatly compounded by fentanyl, a highly potent and often fatal synthetic opioid drug first approved by the Food and Drug Administration for use as a pain reliever and an anesthetic. So, we're going to get some context today from our guests about the use of opioids and the role that they play in our society, what fentanyl is, what are some prevention strategies, and so Suzanne's going to give us a little introduction.
So in looking at national data sourced from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institute on Drug Abuse, drug overdoses are one of the leading causes of injury death in adults, and they've risen over the past several decades in the United States. Overdoses involving synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and stimulants like cocaine and methamphetamine have also risen in recent years. And drug overdose deaths involving heroin rose from 3,036 people in 2010 to 15,469 people in 2016. So clearly significant growth there, unfortunately. And since 2016, the numbers of reported deaths has trended downward. So we had 13,165 in 2020, 9,173 in 2021, and 5,871 in 2022. So while the total number of heroin-involved overdose deaths decreased over this three-year period, the proportion of these deaths involving both heroin and fentanyl dramatically increased to nearly 80% in 2022.
All right. So in response to this alarming increase in use and deaths, the federal government created a program to help areas hardest hit by the renewed overdose epidemic. The common thread among all of our guests today is that their connection is to a federal program called Overdose Data to Action, for which the acronym is known as OD2A. On a grand scale, OD2A supports local jurisdictions by helping them to implement prevention activities and collect accurate, comprehensive, and timely data about non-fatal and fatal overdoses. We want to use that data to enhance programming and surveillance efforts. Now, nationwide, there are 40 established local jurisdictions, which include portions of Ohio. Cuyahoga, Franklin, and Hamilton counties work in partnership with the State Health Department to administer the activities described. So here locally, CCBH, the Board of Health, the Cuyahoga County Board of Health, is the recipient of the federal grant funding provided by the Centers for Disease Control, who we know as the CDC. So CCBH then works with a group of local subgrantees to build cohesive programs that reach people throughout communities and also to close gaps in accessing services. So the subgrantees represent areas such as behavioral health, community organizations, health systems, public health, and public safety.
There are currently 13 subgrantees who are part of the Cuyahoga County's OD2A local network. Those include Case Western Reserve University Big Young Center, Center for Health Affairs, the Centers, Cleveland Department of Public Health, Cleveland State University, the Hispanic Urban Drug Minority Alcoholism Drug Abuse Outreach Program, the Medical Examiner's Office, Metro Health, Project White Butterfly, Sisters of Charity, Thrive Peer Recovery Services, Thrive for Change, and the Woodrow Project.
A lot of centers and a lot of thrives that are going on today.
Doing great work, we might add.
They are. They're all doing great work. All right. So, as I mentioned, we have several guests with us in studio today. Three people who play key roles in addressing the local opioid epidemic. First of all, I'd like to introduce Kristen Hess. Kristen is the clinical education specialist for the Office of Opioid Safety at Metro Health. Her background includes work as a paramedic, a firefighter, and a flight nurse specialist. She is currently recognized as a certified correctional healthcare professional and is studying to obtain her certification as a certified addiction registered nurse. Kristen's goal is to provide Metro Health's clinical staff with the necessary education, resources, and support to provide patients with every opportunity for recovery. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're very glad that you could be here. We also have Bethany Roebuck, who is the executive director of Thrive for Change. Bethany has a bachelor's degree in psychology and an associate's degree in paralegal studies from the University of Akron, and she's been working in the behavioral health field since 2018. Bethany started her professional career at a technology-based nonprofit where she learned about business development, grant writing, marketing, and collective impact. Welcome, Bethany.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you. And finally, we have Stephanie Shorts, and Stephanie Shorts is the Project Dawn and Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator for Metro Health Office of Opioid Safety. She manages the Project Dawn walk-in clinics, Metro Health's Syringe Exchange Mobile Unit, the Naloxbox Program, and the Harm Reduction Vending Machine. Stephanie began volunteering with the Syringe Exchange Program and Project Dawn in 2013 and has been employed at Metro Health since 2018. Thank you for being here, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So as you can see, just from the introductions, we have a wide range of capabilities here. We have people who have done things that I would imagine some of the rest of us have never done. So they have some great stories to tell. So we're going to start off with Stephanie.
Stephanie, again, we're glad you're here with us. Let's start our conversation by talking about fentanyl. We hear a lot about it. Why do you think that fentanyl is being mixed with opioids?
In Cuyahoga County, there really is no real heroin present in the drug supply anymore. The past several years, fentanyl has taken over. It's much cheaper to make and has pretty much replaced the heroin supply. Access to things like the dark web makes them more accessible, where people can buy these drugs online. And much of the fentanyl is imported from Mexico and China. The percent of drugs seized by Ohio State Patrol and other organizations is probably less than 5% of it is heroin. All of our drugs in our area contain fentanyl, so the cocaine, the methamphetamine, the pills, and so we're really working to educate people that are using drugs, not just heroin and fentanyl, that they have a potential risk for overdose. The OD2A Component B syringe testing program, which we recently started in partnership with the medical examiners, is very important to help educate the community about what drugs they are using or what drugs they think they are using versus what they are actually using and what's in their supply. We've seen a great deal of interest so far among participants willing to provide us with a used syringe to be tested, and we get the reports back with within a week to a week and a half, and we're able to educate them what is present in their drug supply and how they can better keep themselves safe.
And so you're testing the syringes themselves?
Correct.
Okay. And then I noticed that also when we were talking before we started the show, there are test strips available to actually test the drugs as mm-hmm. well. Could you speak to, you know, when do those test strips come out and become available, and how widespread is their availability?
So the fentanyl testing strips were originally created for urine screenings, but probably about 2018, Cuyahoga County, all of the harm reduction organizations in our area started utilizing them as a harm reduction tool so that people can make informed decisions about their drug use. They were still considered paraphernalia, the test strips were, until 2023, but we were still distributing them, and many other agencies were also distributing them as well. Data shows that we collected from our program that 83% of people who had a positive fentanyl test strip changed their behavior in a positive way. So people are making sure they have naloxone nearby. They're maybe not using the drug if it tests positive for fentanyl. They're maybe using less or making sure someone is with them, also that they can stay safe. So the test strips are working. People are using them, and it's an important tool in the toolbox. And then in 2023, probably mid-year, xylazine testing strips also became available. And that's when we started seeing xylazine, which is a horse tranquilizer, also mixed in our drug supply with the fentanyl as well.
Always something new, you know, always something to watch out for. Thankfully, you all are on the job to really educate us. Do you think that we'll see a time when fentanyl fades away, or is it here to stay with us?
I think that it may fade away a little bit. There's always something new that's going to, you know, replace one drug.
If I could add something to that about whether or not we'll see fentanyl fade away or if it's here to stay, I think that fentanyl, because it's synthetic, there's a lot of different analogs that can come out for it. And the producers can make small changes so that it's less detectable and also less likely to be prosecuted. So I think that, you know, for the time being, versions of fentanyl or potentially other stronger, more potent substances are here to stay. But we are seeing, as more attention is drawn to fentanyl and criminalizing it, other drugs like xylazine come into the supply.
It seems like there's always somebody willing to be creative, right, to create these crimes.
I think it's really important to recognize as well that there's a lot of trends that they're changing who they're targeting, and we're really seeing our youth being targeted. And so part of the education I do is like with our pediatricians and with parents, and saying, you know, we're targeting our children now. They're making these pills look more like candy. They have done even things like melted down Jolly Ranchers and added fentanyl. And, you know, the DEA One Pill Can Kill initiative is huge in showing how children, Steph mentioned about the dark web, but your kids can go on a cell phone and have access to through regular social media and purchasing things. So it's really, it's opening the doors to the market of fentanyl to people that maybe necessarily wouldn't have been there before. So it just speaks on, it is here to stay, and it is so inexpensive to make that it takes a lot to keep ahead of this.
So this is really where someone could theoretically go on the internet and just find out how to make fentanyl and could actually manufacture it themselves. Is it that simple to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not on a large scale, but I'm saying, you know,
I don't know that that's the trend that we're necessarily seeing here. We're seeing what a lot of the data that we get and a lot of the meetings that we have, like through ONIC, Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center, say that the precursors are coming from China and it is being manufactured down in Mexico. So it's not something that necessarily that we're manufacturing the fentanyl. It's the ease of purchasing it and opening that Pandora's box to children, that there's a whole emoji code that you can look, and certain emojis stand for, this is represents an Adderall, a Percocet, or something like that, and they can purchase it through social media and then even pay through things like Cash Apps. And so it's getting ahead of those trends, and through the work that Steph's team and OD2A grantees do is what helps parents and everybody to be aware of this and to stay ahead of that curve.
So that really illustrates the international impact of this, mm-hmm. of the entire crisis, right? Here we just said that, you know, we're more worried about access rather than manufacturing, but the mm-hmm. manufacturing is, you know, certainly a key component of it as well. So mm-hmm. So Kristen, let's talk a little bit about what you do. You've been connected to the medical field for many years, and you've been directly involved for caring for people that have been in difficult or sometimes life-threatening situations. So what moved you to expand your focus from initially working as a paramedic to now providing on-demand acute care to people in terms of substance use?
Thank you. That is a really good question, and I will try to keep it to the Campbell Soup condensed version for you. It really was my time at the correctional center. During COVID, I was a nurse. I started out my career, as you said, as a firefighter and paramedic, and my goal was to be a flight nurse. And I was proud to say that I did that for just shy of 9 years. And in my time, in any hat that I've worn at MetroHealth for the last 22 years, I encountered patients who were affected by the substance use epidemic. And whether that was on LifeLight, flying someone who had just had an overdose, and working in the neonatal intensive care unit and working with a baby that had neonatal abstinence syndrome. So I always saw different lenses, but it was really during my time at the correctional center during COVID that I actually got to see our exam team through MetroHealth that really works to ensure addiction care for those who are incarcerated. And it doesn't matter why that person is there, they work so hard to ensure the care that they can get to find and maintain their sobriety. And so when I saw that and the opportunity to take this role happened, I was like, you know what, I want to pursue this. And it was also at that time that I was going back to school to continue my education, which is so important. And I reconnected with a childhood friend that had struggled with opioid use disorder for years and was actively human trafficked in Cleveland. And through interviewing her for a school project, it ignited my fire and reignited my compassion towards the substance use population. And when I saw that opportunity, I said, I can do more on this front. I'd always been at really action-packed jobs, and even though this is more of an administrative role, I said, this is something I want to do. And so that's where my heart is now.
And you know you can do so much good because you're training others to recognize what you saw. So that's hugely important. Yes. Good for you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Public Health Matters, brought to you locally by Radio 1 and the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. A reminder that you can connect with us as the Cuyahoga County Board of Health online at ccbh.net. You can reach us Monday through Friday from 8:30 to 4:30 at 216-201-2000. And you can access our clinic directly at 216-201-2041. So, Kristen, let's keep going with a couple things for you. In working for a major health system such as MetroHealth, there are a lot of things that you need to consider when addressing major health issues, right? There are a lot of things, chronic illnesses from cancer and diabetes to things that are more spontaneous in the moment, like COVID. There's a common element to them all, and that's education. And you alluded to that. Both providers and patients need as much information as they can to make the best decisions possible for them as individuals. So how do you help doctors and other care providers support OD2A initiatives when drug use may not be their specialty or their area of expertise?
That is a really good question, because when I came into this role, there was no roadmap to it. MetroHealth is really unique, and I can't find another person who has my job. And I educate clinical staff throughout the entire system. And so I kind of had to pour into myself, because I quickly realized there's so much that I don't know. And how am I going to teach others? And that is, we kind of talked about this earlier, that addiction is always changing. And moment to moment, month to month, the data shows something different. So you have to keep ahead of that. What I really found, and when I started pouring into myself, is I realized what the science of addiction was and how it made my patient, how it helped me to see my patient in a totally different light. It helped to reignite that compassion, and that helps to reduce stigma, and also knowing what resources that we have. So I had to build some education after I realized I need to educate myself before I can educate others, right, and then say, okay, let's break it down to the facts, the science of it, and because we all know doctors and nurses like science and evidence-based practice. And so that's what I did. And then I started making, adding all of the cases throughout the years that I had encountered in the many hats that I wore, so that I brought back the face of addiction and made it brought back the human aspect of it. And that was very successful. And it's really key just to getting them with the science, showing what's going on in our community and updating it when it changes, but then also really hitting home, what are our resources that we have? How do we help a person out of this and be that light and say, there's hope?
It's great when you have some success stories to share. I'm sure, and put a face to those. That really matters.
Absolutely. So Bethany, let's switch over to you now. For the people who are listening who are not familiar with Thrive for Change, could you give us an overview of the type of work that you do?
Yeah, so Thrive for Change is a nonprofit. We are solely focused on harm reduction work. We're a small team of six. We started kind of out of the COVID pandemic. A team member of mine, Ashley Rosser, and myself came together after she had been doing some community outreach and Narcan distribution. We kind of just went into the community because so many things were shutting down and wanted to get things started again. We started to see overdoses increase, and so we took Narcan to the neighborhoods, and we ended up serving about 5,000 people in a few months. And that, long story short, grew into who Thrive for Change is today. Really what makes us unique is that founding by having people with lived experience involved. Most of my team are in recovery. And we do similar to some of the work that Stephanie does. We're a secondary site for the center's syringe service program. We do the naloxone distribution, fentanyl testing strips, safer smoking kits for people who use stimulants. And we do that through weekly services at our office at West 110th in Detroit. Street outreach work, our mail order program where anyone in Ohio can order Narcan and testing strips to be sent to their home discreetly for free. And then through OD2A, we do partnerships with public safety for an EMS naloxone leave behind. We have educational initiatives, linkages to care. And I'm excited to share that so far this year, we've distributed 15,000 Narcan kits across Ohio, and we know about at least 160 overdose fatalities prevented from our work. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something about a lot of your staff having lived experiences. That credibility, with Suzanne and I both working for the Board of Health, we understand how important credibility is. And as Kristen alluded to, right, to have the education and have your portfolio down, right, so you know exactly about what you're talking about, but then to extend that even further and have that credibility as someone who really understands where people are at, how does that help you better navigate things, do you think, on a day-to-day basis?
So for me, I personally don't have lived experience, but I learn so much from my team every single day, and it is critical that we are more inclusive as we move forward in this crisis to bring people with lived experience on and be a part of every conversation that we can. And I have seen the difference that makes when engaging with participants. A lot of my team members are from the neighborhoods where people are that we're serving. And so they've known folks for a long time. They know their loved ones. And it really makes a difference in how they're able to connect and quickly build trust to then facilitate connections to other care people might need.
Bethany, we know about the great work Thrive for Change is doing because our OD2A supervisor, Becky Carnes, has told us wonderful stories about the things you do. We know it can't be easy. So if you had to encapsulate that for us, what are some of the most significant challenges that you face when you're doing your work?
There are many, so it's kind of hard to pinpoint. There's a lot of success stories, which is amazing, and that's what keeps us going in this work. I think as a small organization facing such a crisis, capacity is always a concern. You know, the work in this could never stop. Substance use and the overdose crisis, it's a 24/7 thing. And so we're constantly seeking more resources and partnerships, which is crucial. We can't do this alone. And so our partnerships in the community make this so much more feasible and the impact so much bigger. And so I think that that's a big thing, the constant education for ourselves and then having to educate the community on the benefits of this work and potential misinformation that might be out there. And then, of course, the vicarious trauma that my team might experience through working with folks that are experiencing serious trauma themselves, which is not everyone who uses substances, but we work with a very specific population, people experiencing homelessness and a compounding list of other barriers. So that's a part of it.
Certainly challenging. And we know as Executive Director of Thrive for Change, you have a wealth of responsibility yourself to a number of groups and individuals. So when you're juggling all that, how do you maintain the commonality needed to serve everyone effectively while also being mindful of working on the initiatives that OD2A sets forth for you?
Well, I really think that the OD2A initiatives really complement our work really well, that we already kind of, you know, plan to do in our goals around getting naloxone out into the community, developing strategic partnerships. We were able to bring on someone to lead the OD2A initiatives, but also do some volunteer engagement work. So that's expanded our capacity as well. But I think a very dedicated team is a huge piece for me that allows me to do some of the other work I need to do, like grant writing and partner development, as well as the support from other organizations. I know that I can always call Stephanie or Sarah with Project White Butterfly, one of our other partners, if we need to strategize about something or kind of divide and conquer in the county on, you know, making sure everybody gets reached.
It probably also helps to look around your own offices and see some success stories right with you, right, that are living the dream and they've come back to help others. So that's really incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. I got into this work because I dated somebody who was dealing with substance use, but that really just like opened the door. And I feel like the people that I work with and our participants inspire me every single day to continue this.
That's amazing.
All right, Stephanie, let's talk about what you do a little bit more in depth. So a lot of the work that you do involves connecting directly with the community to minimize risk. And I think something that a lot of people may have heard about but don't necessarily understand the mechanics of it or a lot of the things that surround what it is a syringe exchange program. So could you kind of give us an idea of what that is and how you play into that?
Yeah, so a syringe exchange program, most people just think of syringes. We are definitely much more than syringes. As Bethany kind of mentioned, all of the initiatives and things that their team provides, we do as well. So the goal is to reduce the harms to people using substances. And we really want to minimize the transmission of bloodborne infections due to sharing of supplies and syringes, making sure that used syringes are disposed of properly and brought back to our program so that they're not on the streets, you know, where children could step on them or first responders being poked by them, really, you know, working with the community to help keep the community safe. Providing education to the community in general that, you know, like we said, all of the drug supply contains fentanyl and anyone could be at risk for an overdose if they're using drugs. You know, as Bethany stated as well, we've known many of our participants for over 10 years. And so building that relationship, we don't push treatment on people. And when they are ready, they will come to us and say, I'm done. I want to get help. What are my options? We also provide, you know, resources for food, for clothing. We provide conversation. If somebody's having a bad day and wants to, you know, sit down and talk to us, that's what we're there for. So it's so much more than syringes, you know, and having those success stories when people come back maybe a year later and say, I just wanted to thank you. I've been sober for 9 months. Thank you for, you know, being here and treating me like a real person and providing these services. We really appreciate it. I got a comment like that today from one of our participants. So that helps us, you know, keep doing the work that we're doing.
So when we talk about substance use in general, there's a great deal of stigma attached. And it's from the mindset of the people coming for the service to people in the neighborhood who may have a contrary view to the service that you're providing. So how do you persevere, Stephanie, every day and just kind of keep getting in the van and keep making these connections, as you're saying, and kind of keep everybody else at bay while you're really focusing on the people that you're trying to help?
Mm-hmm. So in the last 10 years that I've been doing this work, we've done a lot of work with stigma. It's gotten a lot better. There's still a lot of work to be done. You know, we invite people who may not agree with what we're doing to shadow our services. We also provide, you know, opportunities for people that are medical students or interns to shadow our services to see what we're all about. And when people can see how these services are actually helping people, all of the things that we do, like I said, we're not just syringes, we're resources, safe use kits, condoms, HIV testing, all of those things, and they've probably been impacted, or a loved one has probably been impacted in some way by substance use disorder. So they can kind of see how all of the moving pieces and parts work. You know, they may have a different view and maybe think twice about kind of not agreeing with everything that we do. You know, it costs over $400,000 to treat one person with HIV over a lifetime. And so when you look at, you know, the cost analysis and the health benefits for providing these services, they're always free to individuals. And, you know, we get a lot of our funding from grants, which we really appreciate. But, you know, it can save a lot of money in the long run if people are able to be safe while they're using drugs. Data shows that it does not increase crime. Having a syringe exchange program in the area, it does not increase use. It doesn't increase discarded syringes on the street. Like I said, we get many more syringes back that we can dispose of properly. Since 2020, when we started our syringe exchange program, we've exchanged over 1.5 million syringes. So that means that many syringes were taken off the street, disposed of properly, and people were given clean supplies to help stay safe.
So when we talk about, just to go back to it for one more second, when we talk about stigma, it's interesting some of the things you said, because there is this notion out there from people I think who are somewhat naive to the inner workings of how this whole environment unfolds. And it's very much the, well, if, you know, if you give someone Narcan, for instance, right, you're encouraging them just to use one more time, right? Or if you're coming into my neighborhood, you're bringing a certain element with you, rather than recognizing the wellness and the protection that you're trying to bring to people, and the education, and using those opportunities to connect with people. So as you say, when somebody gets to the point where they feel like they've had enough, right, they know that they can trust you, and they've seen you, and they recognize you. You all have mentioned this, that, you know, that familiarity with the people that you're serving is so penultimate, right? It's really something you have to connect with. So is that kind of what drives you each day, to kind of just, you know, as I said before, kind of just keep going, and you know that you're going to have success stories amidst all the noise?
Yeah. So I think substance use is usually seen as like a moral failing, I think. And, you know, we've heard countless stories of people who have endured trauma, abuse, generational trauma, you know, human trafficking, medical injuries that cause them, you know, to start using prescription opioids and then let them down this path. But like I said, we do see many success stories, and I think it makes it well worth it when people come back and let us know that they're doing well.
So you're listening to Public Health Matters, brought to you locally by Radio 1 and the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. We are here today with three guests who are very much involved in the administration and the collection of data and trying to administer prevention strategies and deliver education to the community under an umbrella known as Overdose Data to Action, OD2A. So now we're going to continue with our questions.
Bethany, how easy is it to evaluate the impact of the interventions and direct outreach that you're conducting?
So I think that there's a lot of components that we've gotten better at over time. At least I can speak for our organization in measuring impact. Our team does an awesome job trying to make things as easy on the data collection side as we can for our participants, but still track the supplies that we're giving out. We ask questions like Stephanie shared earlier about the prevalence of fentanyl when people use the testing strips, what actions do they take, and then also track referrals to other services. So we're able to capture, you know, when we have talked to somebody about treatment, when they've brought it up to us and we've referred them to one of our partners like the Centers, who's also an OD2A grantee for like something like medication assisted treatment or medication for opioid use disorder, as it's being called now. So we're able to track all of those things in our systems, but there's things that just happen in this work that will never be fully captured. I'm sure that those in this room can also speak to that. We don't know all of the times that our Narcan is used. Oftentimes people underreport. Actually, half of those that we do get reports on never called 911, so they're not even being captured by our emergency medical system. And then there's small things that we do, like giving people a pair of shoes or a meal that day through our outreach that, you know, the impact goes far and beyond the simple data, what it shows.
And it sounds like from what all of our guests are saying that these little things, these connections you make might be that linchpin, that thing that makes somebody say, you know what, I've had enough of this. I know that there's people out there that will really help me that I can trust. And I think that data that you're describing is just so important. The more you can glean, the better. How do you approach conversations about the perceptions of drug use as a disease rather than it being a poor personal choice?
So when I approach people about these different conversations, I think the stories of people's lives is really what makes a difference, and just getting people to understand, while there might have been choices involved along the way, the people who really are struggling and are on the end of like chaotic substance use, there's a lot more going on there. They may have had an injury. They may have complex mental health concerns, experienced trauma. And so I come from a very, I want to say, like, privileged background. And so some might think like it's hard. It would be hard for someone like me to relate. But once I get to know people and I understand their stories and have had my eyes opened to the experiences that people have, and just trying to be a human and get through every day like we all do, it really makes it a difference in those perceptions.
And I think what you said about privilege is brilliant, because those of us that haven't had these struggles, we can see just by getting to know someone and talk to them, they've had to deal with a lot that we never had. We're blessed to never have had that, right? So if they weren't even given a share shake out of the gate, it's going to be a lot harder for them to stay healthy.
Yeah.
So Kristen, I wanted to get back to asking you about a situation that has, I think, a tremendous societal impact. And we talked about sort of the, I don't want to say naivete in terms of ignorance. I think it's maybe just exposure that people have and not understanding the totality of all the things that are connected to opioid use and the other things that comprise the entirety of it. We know that there's a connection between human trafficking and substance use. So how does your work through OD2A help you to address this issue? What do you do in terms of trying to minimize that issue but still connect it back up to the larger piece?
So I would say that there's a lot of work to be done on this front in healthcare, 100%. And that is something that, like I said, I've been in healthcare as a nurse 22 years, 25 plus years, and I did not understand how bad our human trafficking issue is in Ohio, let alone how much substances, specifically opioids and stimulants, play in that. And there is so much work in the healthcare industry because we don't see it. We're not taught it. You would think that you're taught it. As a beautician or as a barber, you actually have to have an hour every like 2 years to renew your license in human trafficking. In healthcare, we don't have to have that. As a nurse and as fire and EMS, you are not mandated to be taught about it. So therefore, there's a big knowledge gap. At Metro Health back in 2023, I happened to stumble upon our forensic unit coordinator, who is now the forensic unit manager, and we kept presenting next to each other. And we started talking to each other, and we realized, wow, our two populations are one and how much they intersect. And I said, I didn't know this about your wheelhouse. She didn't know what resources and things, because I was new into my role, about substance use and what options we have. And so we really sat down and we met and educated each other, and we go, we need to tell the masses about this. And so what we did was we started an education program at Metro Health. And so by doing that, our levels of recognition of specifically women, it happens in men and children as well, but what we're seeing at Metro Health are women that are targeted in human trafficking. And so the first thing is to educate. How are drugs used? Because that's what we're seeing. We're seeing almost all of our patients that have been identified as experiencing human trafficking have active substance use disorder. And so the biggest benefit of having this education, and I could talk to you for hours on this because there's so much more than what I have an opportunity to tell you, but the biggest impact that it has had, especially at Metro Health, is increased recognition of numbers, but also reigniting the compassion and going, you know what? Now I understand when someone has a quota of 7 to 11 men a night, why I need opioids to dull the pain and why I need the stimulants to help keep me going. And I've had the pleasure through this work to meet women who are survivors and to tell me how the substances are being used. And it is just, we've made great strides, but there's so much more work to be done. And so it is not done.
Right. So is it, to kind of round out what you said, is it uncommon or more common for people who are perpetrating the human trafficking to have the people that they're enslaving, so to speak, mm-hmm. become dependent on them in a substance type of way? Is that a strategy?
It's
as
both.
Well?
So human yeah. traffickers go out and they look for anyone who has a need. And so whether it's they recruit a child through a video game mm-hmm. and they get access to a child, they will oftentimes introduce opioids to start being able to control, because we know opioids reduce your anxiety and they also reduce the physical pain. And that act of having intercourse 7 to 11 times a night is extremely painful. They also actively look for someone who is struggling with substance use disorder. And so they use the substances as a means of control. They can accrue a drug debt, things like that. Again, I could talk to you for hours on this because it has opened up my eyes so much. And so it's really important to know that. So it's both ways. It really does. And what the sad thing is in Ohio is that our women, especially, I speak women, but again, it's across the board, but we primarily see women in northeastern Ohio, you have to have 30 days of sobriety before you can go off to a treatment center specific for human trafficking. The traffickers recruit from treatment facilities until diagnosis. So these women have to run the gauntlet to get treatment. And so there's a lot of work to be done. I would love to see detox facilities that are specific for human trafficking, because we're number 5 in overdose deaths in Ohio, and we're number 5 for human trafficking with the latest data. And that is not the end of where the parallels are. There's so many similarities between the two. So that's why I say the work is not done. And the key is to educate and to be able to identify so that we can say, let's treat both the human trafficking and the substance use disorder, because you have to treat all of it.
It sounds like there's just so many layers.
There are so many.
From physical well-being, mental health, substance abuse, there's just so many, I should say substance use, but the abusers by the traffickers. And it's just so many layers that's why this is so difficult to conquer, right? So difficult.
But there's hope.
So, Kristen, as an educator, you alluded to the fact that you're trying to do a better job or as well of a job as you can to inform your colleagues about things to look for. So yes. What are the things that you would address with, because a lot of physicians, as we interpret it, not being people who don't work in a hospital environment, it's a multitude of specialists, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's got their compartment or their lane that they're in, as opposed to decades ago when it was more of a generalist approach. So how do you get people who are very focused on their particular discipline to be able to recognize the things that you're speaking of?
So the two things, substance use disorder and both human trafficking, you will identify a patient in whatever wheelhouse you have. So I think back on my time when I was a flight nurse, and I can think back to, oh my goodness, I didn't see it, but that was probably a human trafficking case, or I didn't know how to help that person in that moment. I've gone and talked to OR teams about, if your patient is struggling with a substance, what do you need to know and what resources do we have? So I try to use the many hats that I've worn and also continuing to educate myself to tailor the education to their wheelhouse, because we see an increase in stimulant prescribing in pediatrics, and then children will go out and try to attempt to purchase an Adderall, and here it's pressed cocaine and fentanyl. And so opening those eyes to the pediatric world, it's in every lane. And so it's really tailoring that education and saying, these are the resources that things like OD2A can bring to help your patient, no matter what your area of expertise is. But it's really breaking that glass and saying, it doesn't matter what lane you're in, you're going to take care of a patient with substance use and also maybe experiencing human trafficking. So it's both.
So you're listening to Public Health Matters, brought to you locally by Radio 1 and the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. You can reach us online at ccbh.net. You can reach us by phone Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30 at 216-201-2000. And you can reach our clinic directly at 216-201-2041.
Stephanie, in terms of prevention strategies, there are many ways to help those in need. What is Project Dawn, and tell us about its value?
So Project Dawn stands for Deaths Avoided with Naloxone. So it's a naloxone distribution program as well as an overdose reversal education program. So not only do we go out into the community and provide naloxone kits free of charge, we also work with local agencies such as treatment centers. You know, we do trainings at gas stations, things like that, with different agencies so people can recognize an overdose and learn how to reverse one. The naloxone distribution program is secondary prevention, so people are already using the drugs. We're working to help prevent the fatal overdoses, not the actual drug use. Again, we're trying to just keep people safe, keep people alive, so that when they're ready to enter treatment, you know, they have the resources and the tools to do so.
And we love that we hear that common theme, as with any illness, of not blaming, right? Mm-hmm. Not blaming someone who's trying to get help and trying to live healthfully. Did Project Dawn plant the seed for using vending machines to distribute naloxone?
So we didn't plant the seed per se. There were many conversations between, you know, many different harm reduction agencies within Cuyahoga County several years ago, particularly with the Adams Board, which kind of sparked the idea and, you know, where the pilot program of having five vending machines throughout the county came from. We had heard different presentations regarding vending machines. Many of them were placed out west, you know, in California or Nevada. And they also have one in southern Ohio. So we really just wanted this resource to be available in Cuyahoga County. It's something where it's 24/7 access, no judgment, it's always free, and people can access the vending machine, you know, to have harm reduction supplies such as naloxone, condoms, fentanyl testing strips. And in partnership with Cuyahoga County, we just installed a vending machine at the Justice Center last week. We're still working to get it online. But then we're also looking at adding an additional vending machine to the Juvenile Justice Center as well. So, you know, this can help combat the stigma as well, putting it out there, letting people know, like, hey, there are resources available for these things, educating people on how to stay safe, giving people the tools to be well.
So, Stephanie, would you consider the use of the vending machines a success so far? Have you gotten good feedback and high usage, we'll say?
Yeah. So compared to some of the vending machines throughout the country, I think we've tried to collect minimal data so that it doesn't create a barrier for people accessing the machine. So there is no special PIN required. The Metro Health machine has the PIN posted on the machine. And we typically vend anywhere from 40 to 90 items per month out of the vending machine. And, you know, it's people are still becoming aware that the machines exist and that they are there. You know, Kristen does a lot of her education with providers in the hospital system, and now they know that they can refer their patients to utilize the vending machine if needed. So I do see them being very successful, and the fact that, you know, other agencies want to partner with us to be able to place vending machines, it's all a good sign.
Bethany, how can we get more people into treatment for substance use issues?
So I feel like it's still much more difficult than it should be to access treatment, especially for the folks that are most at risk. And this is just speaking from my own work and experience. It feels like you have to still like know someone who knows someone and have a contact at a treatment center to really get someone in quickly to a high quality treatment center. And you have to kind of vet them. So, you know, when we are seeing complex health conditions that people have, or someone who is experiencing psychosis and mental health concerns, or they may have a wound because of xylazine, which causes wounds, those can all really complicate where you're able to send someone for treatment. So even if someone approaches you that day, there's still several hoops they have to jump through, and you have to work with them to find them the right place, depends on the level of medication that they're on, all of these different things. And so I think that we need higher quality treatment, although there are some amazing ones out there. I really do think that we need to make it easier. We need to increase access to medication for opioid use disorder, which is an incredible evidence-based treatment that we have very strict laws on in Ohio. And we need to increase warm handoffs between different levels of care, as well as access to case management. Our case managers in the Cleveland area have such high caseloads, and it takes weeks to get a new case manager depending on where you're trying to go for care. And in those 2 weeks, someone might not feel like making, you know, that 10th phone call to access. Right. So
a lot of barriers, it sounds like.
I just wanted to add really quick that we started a new program at Metro Health called the Substance Use Navigators in our ED. And it started in May of 2024, and it has been massively successful. These are individuals who work under our program manager. She is a social worker, and these are essentially lay individuals. Some of them are CDCAs, but essentially they have the heart to meet a person where they're at. And they have screened over 3,800 patients just since this program started in May, and they were able to get 209 of those patients in detox. I have a lot of other boring statistics that highlights their amazing work, but really what it does is it helps the doctors and nurses to engage those patients, and they meet them at the bedside. They are there to say, hey, these are our resources, and if they say, no, I'm not ready for treatment, here's a harm reduction kit. And it has been amazingly successful, and they are just a phenomenal team. And so that is something that we're really proud of, and I would like to see that across all hospital systems, because it's not about the initials behind your name, it's about the heart and meeting that patient where they're at and knowing how to communicate in person first language and all of those things. And our team has done an absolutely amazing job, and I think that's a really important trend, and I'd like to see that, because they also have conversations about medicated assisted treatment and give them different options and just say, hey, I'm here. Next time you're here, I'm here if you need us.
And that continuity of care can be so important, like you're saying, to overcome those barriers, that the people are right there that can help them.
So, Kristen, to follow up on that, we really need to be mindful that we're not keeping score. There's not a method of validation to say you're in treatment, you're not. We encountered you. You didn't take us up on it. It's not that. Right. It's about you giving people enough resources for when they're ready, as you mentioned before.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And just saying, you know what, it's okay if you're not ready, but you know what, the next time, if you change your mind, here's a card and here's a number, and we will be here and we will hold your hand through this. And they've done a phenomenal job. And I hate to get into all the data points, and I don't want to, but it just shows that when you have a team that is their sole purpose, to meet a patient where they're at, you can move mountains.
Well, this has been a great discussion amongst everybody. I want to really thank our guests for coming down, Kristen Hess and Stephanie Shorts from Metro Health, and Bethany Robeck from Thrive for Change. You all have really, I think, enlightened us in a very introductory way, because I think each of you, we could probably spend 2 or 3 hours with you talking about all the various things that you do. But I wanted to make sure that we had a good range of guests today, because I wanted to provide sort of an overall perspective, I think, that gives people a little bit of information and they can work with it and move forward in the way that they feel is best for them. So to remind everybody, there are some resources we could recommend to you. If you'd like to learn more about what Thrive for Change does, please visit their website at thrive4change.org. To learn more about Project Dawn or the various things that Stephanie and Kristen talked about, please visit metrohealth.org and look for their Office of Opioid Safety. At ccbh.net, Cuyahoga County Board of Health's website, we have an overdose data dashboard and surveillance information, which is available. And that also includes alerts that we issue as the Board of Health when we see increased activity that is at an alarming level that we want to make sure the community knows about. And we refer that back to the substances that may be used, or the manner in which they're being used. Those can be things that we want to make sure the community is aware of at the appropriate time. And then, as a good resource for state and national data, visit harmreductionohio.org. Gives you a lot of good information and a lot of data that you can use if you're going to have more conversations about this, or if you'd like to do your own research. So thank you again. We are the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. You can reach us at ccbh.net. You can reach us by phone, 216-201-2000. You can reach our clinic, 216-201-2041. And a reminder, this is Public Health Matters, brought to you collaboratively by Radio One and the Cuyahoga County Board of Health.
This has been Public Health Matters, brought to you every month by the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. For more information about today's topics and more, you can always visit the Cuyahoga County Board of Health online at ccbh.net. Tune in on the third Saturday of next month at 12 noon for the next edition of Public Health Matters.